Mr. Cater, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you.
Can you hold on 1 second?
Go ahead. I'm okay.
Are you okay with that?
Thank you, Your Honor. The principal issue in this case is whether plaintiff's supervisor, the one who proposed his removal, and the one who said that plaintiff was acting like the wrong kind of nigger, was a proximate cause in plaintiff's separation. The district court said that Miller, that supervisor, that his involvement was too remote and too indirect to be a proximate cause. But in fact, that it is undisputed on the record in this case that Mr. Miller was very much directly and involved in the proposal. He was the one who signed the proposal. He was the one who worked with the human resources people to develop what was in the proposal. And he was the one, but for his determination and his determination alone, that the proposal would be for removal, but for Mr. Miller's decision to propose removal as opposed to some other penalty, Mr. Hampton would not have been removed.
Wouldn't you have a stronger case if, as I understand it, Henwood, who made the actual decision, could not go higher than what Miller recommended, but he could go lower, so that it was a ceiling but not a floor? Wouldn't your argument be stronger if Henwood couldn't have gone lighter than that? In other words, if Miller said, I want him fired, and Henwood couldn't go lighter, well, there's nothing more severe than that, but if Henwood was not able to go lighter, and he was able to go lighter.
He was able to go lighter. The fact that he didn't does not render Miller any less a proximate cause in the ultimate decision to remove Mr. Hampton. The fact that if he had the ability to elevate it, and he decided, for example, if he had decided to elevate it, which is not the facts of this case, then that would break the chain. If he had the ability to elevate it, and it came out the same way that it did now, then perhaps you would have to argue about, well, did he rely on Miller? Did he rely on facts? Was it independent? You would go down that line of argument. But the fact that he was stuck with the inability to elevate it means that had Miller proposed anything less than removal, we would not be here talking about a removal case.
But he wasn't stuck at termination if he had the ability to go lighter than that.
He could have gone. He could have mitigated it. He could have said, I don't sustain these charges.
Is there any evidence in the record that any employees have ever been subjected to less discipline for offenses like this?
I don't recall the extent that the record was developed
Isn't that critical to your argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that as it's reported, there are reported cases from the Foreign Service Grievance Board where the discipline for these types of allegations of misconduct are less than removal. There's no requirement of removal. There's a table of penalties.
That's in the record?
Those are not in the record, Your Honor. They're published decisions.
Whether there's anything in the record showing that Foreign Service employees who engage in this kind of misconduct are ever subjected to less than discharge.
My recollection, Your Honor, is that the table of penalties is in
I understand what the table of penalties said. I was asking whether, in fact, that was my question.
Right. To answer your question, I do not recall that specific issue was addressed in the documents that were submitted to the court on summary judgment. But I would submit to Your Honor that it is a fact that not every single Foreign Service agent who has ever been charged with an allegation of inappropriate travel voucher usage has been removed. There's no requirement in the law. There's no requirement in their table of penalties. The table of penalties says reprimand to removal. So it is simply not the case that everyone is removed. If it were the case, it would be a different issue, perhaps.
Well, how about the fact that didn't he threaten some of these hotel people with a lawsuit if they disclose the actual bills
What Mr. Hampton did was he wrote a letter, I believe, or contacted the hotel employees and said, I do not authorize you to release my documents to the investigators from the Department of Agriculture. And Henwood made much of this. He thought that that was an admission of guilt. And I submit to Your Honor that it is not an admission of guilt. It is probably a sensible thing to do if you consider the circumstance that Mr. Hampton was in. His removal had already been proposed. He had already responded. An investigation had already been done. And now Henwood is saying, well, you know what? I'm not sure that I have everything I need. Instead of saying, I don't have everything I need, and therefore I'm not going to sustain these charges, Henwood says, I'm not sure I have everything I need. Therefore, I want to juice up this investigation. I want them to go further.
Did the investigation reinforce or confirm what the previous findings indicate?
I'm not sure.
Isn't the investigation that he initiated the one that revealed the allegation that that the plaintiff had contacted the hotel?
Yes, that is correct.
Right. So, I mean, doesn't that? I'm not sure how that helps your case.
All I'm suggesting is that it is perhaps possible to draw the inference that Henwood did. Oh my goodness, this man has contacted the hotel and said, don't cooperate with the investigation. And therefore, he must be guilty. He must have something to hide. And it is also possible that Mr. Hampton contacted the investigators and said, don't cooperate with them. You comply with the law. You make them subpoena these documents if they want these documents, because he didn't trust them, because he was already where he was. He already had his removal proposed. And he was in a situation where he simply did not trust what was going on the other side of the table. He didn't trust the investigators. He certainly didn't trust Miller. He, at this point, didn't trust Henwood. Why is Henwood supplementing the investigation? If he doesn't have enough information,
To find out exactly how much money he stole from the government.
Your Honor.
You say that, well, why would he do such a thing? Because he was already being proposed to be terminated. But there's also the matter of reimbursement. And he took from the government coffers $9,000 or more that he wasn't entitled to. And the investigation certainly could continue to find out exactly how much more.
Your Honor, you state that as if it's a fact. It's not a fact. It's an allegation. There is exactly as much evidence in this record that Mr. Hampton falsified those travel vouchers as there is that Mr. Miller did. Mr. Miller's supervisor, Cornelius Smith, at one point said, Mr. Miller engaged in what was both a covert and overt assault on Mr. Hampton. This is Miller's supervisor talking about Miller and her relationship with Hampton. She said, an overt and covert assault. There is no evidence in this record. There was no evidence presented before the Foreign Service Grievance Board, none before the Department of Agriculture, that Mr. Hampton falsified these documents. These documents were beyond chain of custody for 3 years. Nobody knew where they were. Nobody knew what happened to them. Is it possible that Mr. Hampton did it? Is that an inference that can be drawn? Certainly. But it's not the only inference. And the evidence in this record, it is just as equally likely that Mr. Miller did it as did Mr. Hampton. And in the context of summary judgment, that means the court must conclude that it was not Mr. Hampton, that he did not falsify these. So we don't come here with a finding of falsification. That's a disputed issue of fact. If this would be an appropriate time, if there's no further questions at this moment, I would like to reserve my remaining time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Lyons? Good morning.
May it please the Court, Jane Lyons on behalf of the Secretary of Agriculture. The heart of this case is misconduct warranting termination. USDA fired Mr. Hampton because it lost all faith and confidence in his ability to perform as a member of the Foreign Service ethically and with good judgment, after an extensive investigation demonstrated, among other things, that he had submitted false claims for official travel during six different trips taken in the years 2002 and 2003. The issue before the court is whether summary judgment on Hampton's race discrimination claim was appropriate, where there's no evidence of racial bias by the official who removed Hampton, that's Mr. Henwood, or the members of the Foreign Service Grievance Board who approved it.
Plaintiff says that he points to the Miller's deposition, and Miller himself says he reviewed the table of penalties and concluded that it warranted removal. And Lacey confirmed that.
That's right.
She said that the first level person, i.e. Miller, has the ultimate decision about the level of discrimination.
Well, I think what's important in this
record... So is that right? Did Miller have any choice in the matter? Could Miller have recommended less than discharge?
It is theoretically possible that Mr. Miller could have recommended less than discharge.
Does that mean yes, he could have? He had the legal authority to do that?
He had the legal authority to do it. What is important about this record is that the first person to review the results of the investigation conducted by the compliance review staff is Lacey Muir. And Lacey Muir, a human resources professional, concludes that she's the first person in the agency to conclude that removal is warranted based on the existing record at that point.
But is he right that Miller didn't have to follow that recommendation?
He did not have to follow that recommendation as a matter of law. As a matter of common sense on this record, I think it's hard to conclude that other...
And why is that? Is there evidence that people are always fired for this kind of behavior? Is that the point?
No, Your Honor. There's no evidence in the record that similarly situated employees were ever treated differently than Mr. Hampton. And likewise, there is no evidence in the record they were about whether similarly situated people were treated the same. On the other hand, certainly cases in other courts, such as Hall versus Giant Food, confirm that when an employee is guilty of serious misconduct, removal is an appropriate penalty.
And Henwood wasn't bound by Miller, except he couldn't go higher than termination.
That's correct.
If Miller had said, give him 90 days or something like that, suspension, Henwood could not have terminated him.
That is also correct, Your Honor. If he was bound by the upper limit of whatever Mr. Miller.
Yeah. So the plaintiff's point is that your theory is that there was no room for, even assuming Miller's racial animus, there was no room for that to have affected any of the decisions because these other people were involved who didn't even know Miller, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the response to that is that, look, Miller, you concede, Miller made a decision, in other words.
Miller
made a judgment.
Yes.
And the plaintiff's point is, look, a jury could conclude that, why couldn't a jury reasonably conclude that that judgment was infected by his racial animus?
Because in this case, summary judgment is appropriate because the record conclusively reveals another non-discriminatory reason for the decision.
Which is what?
The falsification of official travel vouchers, among other things.
I'll try once more. But the plaintiff's argument is that the penalty for that, falsification of travel vouchers, was a penalty that was within the judgment of Miller.
It is within the judgment of Miller, Your Honor, but as Judge Randolph pointed out, it's stealing money from the taxpayer and the agency. It's very serious misconduct for a person
No question about it.
But it's also a position of extraordinary trust that Mr. Miller occupies.
Uh-huh.
So
you want us to rule as a matter of law that whenever there's misconduct of this kind, namely falsifying a travel voucher, that there's no possibility the plaintiff could prove that the selection of the penalty, even though you can see that the penalty could be less than discharge, might be discriminatory? Is that what you want us to
do? No, we don't need a rule that's that broad, Your Honor. Obviously, each case is going to depend heavily on the record. In this case...
Well, I asked my question because you cited a Supreme Court case that said this is a terrible thing for someone to do, right?
I don't think there's any dispute that it's a terrible thing for an employee to steal...
But I'm asking you, is this a question of law that we should, we are going to rule that under any circumstances, cases like this have to be dismissed? Or is there room for where there's judgment to be exercised about the level of the penalty, whether it's firing or suspension, that the person making that judgment could be infected by racial animus? That's technically possible, right?
It is technically possible, but in a
why not here?
It is technically possible. The question ultimately is not whether Mr. Hampton committed the misconduct, but whether or not Mr. Henwood believed he committed the misconduct. And on this record, it would be very difficult to conclude otherwise, as the district court pointed out.
You can't retry in this forum, he can't retry the question whether he is the one that falsified the travel records.
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting question. It's de novo review. He should be bound by the findings of the Foreign Service Grievance Board that his actions constituted serious misconduct, whether that is the underlying falsification of the travel vouchers or the interfering with the investigation. There's also a serious conflict of interest presented.
I guess my question is, could he come in bringing a Title VII action, can he seek to prove that he is not the one that falsified the travel bill? Despite the fact, the question is, why was he fired? Was he fired for discrimination reasons? Not was he unjustly fired for falsifying records when he didn't falsify them? But your point, as I understand it, you just said, is that the question is what the Foreign Service Grievance Committee thought. Or Hampton thought, or not Hampton, who's
that? Mr. Henwood.
Henwood, right.
That's the ultimate question under this court's traditional analysis. You know, the summary judgment standard is whether or not Mr. Hampton has produced sufficient evidence for a reasonable jury to find that USDA's asserted reasons are a pretext for discrimination. That's the standard.
Let's assume, just to follow up a little bit on Judge Randolph's question, let's assume that For all practical purposes right now, there's no doubt that the plaintiff falsified the records and called the hotel. And let's just assume that's the case, either because he can't challenge it or because he hasn't, or because whatever, we look at the record and say no reasonable jury could conclude otherwise. Let's just assume that that's the case. You agree, right? There is a table of penalties for this kind of behavior, correct?
Yes, there is.
And what is that? It goes from firing to what? Down to what?
Reprimand, probably.
Reprimand, okay. So, and you also agree, I take it, that based on our earlier questions, that Miller had discretion here, correct?
Yes. True.
Yes, he did. Okay. So I still don't understand why since the government concedes that there is a range of possible sanctions going all the way down to reprimand, why a reasonable juror couldn't conclude that as bad as his behavior is, Miller's selection of firing as opposed to something less than firing was affected by his racial animus? That's my only question.
There are multiple reasons why, Your Honor. First of all, the limited evidence of racial animus is disconnected entirely from the process that culminates in Mr. Hampton's termination. Uh-huh. There's a remark several years before, and in the intervening years, Mr. Miller is giving Mr. Hampton glowing recommendations. Mr. Hampton's getting promoted. He's receiving awards. There's no evidence of any connection between any animus and the actions in this case. More importantly, though, Mr. Miller's actions in the chain of events that lead to Mr. Hampton's termination he's a part you can pull out, and the same events will occur.
Well, but if I'm not convinced about your second point, can we affirm this on your first point? Namely, that even assuming that Miller had discretion, the racial animus is unconnected to this event. Is that?
You can certainly affirm on that grounds.
And how far back was his last, What was the last thing he said? There's several claims about Miller, right?
The most specific remark attributed to Mr. Miller is in 2002.
2002.
Mr. Hampton admits that he heard about the remark from a woman named Patricia Perkins in 2002.
Okay, and when did this all happen?
The events, his termination was proposed in 2005 and approved by the Foreign Service Grievance Board in 2006.
And during the 2002 and subsequent period, Miller was giving him good evaluations?
Yes. Okay. And his employment is otherwise, you know, unchanged, essentially. That's the most specific remark. The other things that Mr. Hampton proffered by way of evidence of animus are not of much weight. One is that nobody in the front office wanted to see Hampton promoted. No one in the front office wanted to see Hampton promoted. Mr. Hampton alleges that Mr. Miller said that. That's connected to nobody's race, that remark.
Well,
it's vague.
Promoted.
Pardon me? And he was promoted, exactly.
And Miller recommended it.
Miller did not have a primary role at that point. Cornelius Smith, a woman, Catherine Cornelius Smith, was his reviewer.
All this emphasis on Miller's discretion, it's Henwood's discretion.
It's Henwood's discretion that matters. That's correct, Your Honor.
And let me ask you about this Griffin case, because that's the case I thought this case really hinges on.
Which case, Your Honor?
Griffin versus the Washington Convention Center.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where our court said, evidence of a subordinate's bias is relevant where the ultimate decision maker is not insulated from the subordinate's influence. And here, the insulation is Henwood could have reprimanded him only.
Yes, Your Honor. Also, there's no evidence that Henwood ever talked about the proposal or the penalty with Mr. Miller. There's also the subsequent investigation which reinforces Mr. Henwood's reasons and adds to his reasons for selecting the penalty that he did. And ultimately, it is Mr. Henwood's and the Foreign Service Grievance Board's decision.
But could they have gone below removal, given Miller's recommendation?
Yes. Yes.
They could, even though Miller recommended that he be fired, they could have done less?
Henwood absolutely could have done less. But he did not, and there is no evidence at all of any racial animus on his part. And that's the key facts in this case. I see that my time has expired, and I've gone over.
I just want to ask you one question. Hold on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just hold on 1 second. Oh, I see. It works the other way. So if Miller had chosen a lesser penalty, then Henwood could not have increased it, correct?
That is correct.
I see. Okay, got it. Thank you.
Can I ask you just briefly to talk about the conflict of interest charge that was not used? Is there anything, and I just don't remember, is there anything in the record why that was not used as a basis, that private business he had, and didn't reveal that he was an employee of the Department of Agriculture?
It was used as part of the decision, Your Honor. Mr. Henwood sustains that charge of the failure to disclose the financial interests on the required financial disclosures, and that's at JA 285.
All right, so that's another.
That's another basis. There are multiple bases.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. How much time does Mr. Cater have? Okay, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. To respond specifically to your question, Judge, this court's decisions that track the insulation theory, I believe, are no longer good law after Staub. Staub says that's not the question. The question is simply proximate cause. It's a close analysis, but it's not the same. So the question is not whether there was insulation,
but the insulation would break the proximate cause, would it not?
If it were complete and independent, absolutely, it would be proximate cause. But the question is there proximate cause? If you want to know if there's proximate cause, you start with the fact, I think, that is clear on this record, that but for Miller's recommendation of removal, there would have been no removal. So it is a cause in fact.
Wait, but that, I thought, I see. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
So, but for the recommendation for removal, there could have been no removal. So it was a cause and fact. Clearly, it is, given that it is setting this entire process in motion, it is the first, or certainly one of the early links in the chain of causation.
Well, what about the government's argument that quite, even if you're right about that, that any evidence of racial animus is too distant from this, and that Miller gave him good evaluations. So it's just, it's too distant from this event.
Three points.
Go ahead.
3 points I would make, Your Honor. First, you know, bigotry and racism, I think experience has proved these are not things that are easily cured. They don't evaporate quickly. They tend to last. I think the record is more robust than that. But the fact of the matter is, it's a jury question. It's a question of fact. Here's somebody who tells racist ethnic jokes in the workplace. Here's somebody, you know, who admits to telling jokes about, I'm not sure if he admitted to telling jokes about blacks, but he admits to telling jokes about ethnicities, about blondes, about Scandinavians. We have record evidence that he tells jokes about Asians. This is somebody who has race on his mind. I think that the third point that I would make, the third point that I would make is, look again at Staub. In Staub, the Supreme Court was dealing with comments that were made in 1998. For removal, that was 2004.
Okay, now, asking about Staub, because I'm looking at this quote from that case. A supervisor's biased report may remain a causal factor if the deciding official's independent investigation takes it into account without determining that the adverse action was, apart from the recommendation, entirely justified. Are you saying that Henwood had to have said, I am removing Hampton without regard to the racial animus of Miller?
Three things. First, right. This is not what the district court held. Second, it's not what the government argued. And third, no, I don't think that
I'm asking what you're arguing under Staub, language.
What I'm arguing under Staub is linked to the fact that Miller exclusively had the discretion to propose removal. And it is that link that I'm focused on. I'm not focused on Henwood, which is what the government would like to focus on. I'm focused on Miller. I'm focused on what was in his mind, what was within him, as Justice Alito said. Was he motivated by race when he selected this penalty? And if he was, then under Title VII, under 2000E16, that is a violation of the law.
Not if the ultimate decision maker had the discretion to ignore that or had other justified reasons for firing him.
I think, and as we said in our brief, Your Honor, I think that the argument that you're making goes, if it goes to anything, it goes to relief. It goes to what relief is Mr. Hampton entitled to if he proves that Miller was in fact motivated by race when he made that proposal. I think that that's where that comes out, Your Honor.
Is there judicial review of the Foreign Service Grievance Board's decision?
Can there be? Yes, there can be judicial review.
So we have two tracks. One track is that if, as you said when you opened your argument, that the evidence that it's not entirely certain that your client falsified that, let's just stick with the travel records. And on the face of it, the 42-page decision of the Foreign Service Grievance Board says just the opposite. Now, if you wanted to challenge that, then the way to do it is to bring an action for judicial review of that agency decision, right? If you don't do that, then I don't see how you can, in a Title VII action, reopen the 42 pages of findings by the Foreign Service Grievance Board. I've never heard of that. Do you have some cases that say you can do that?
Well, Your Honor, in an ordinary case, if that situation were to arise, you would bring both a challenge to the Foreign Service Grievance Board decision and a challenge to the Title VII aspects as a mixed case. You would bring them both to the district court. But what happened in this case It is that the Foreign Service Grievance Board said we will not consider Mr. Hampton's Title VII claims. We will not consider his discrimination claims. So in this case, and I think that was error. I think the law says you should. But in this case, they proceeded in two separate tracks. Had it been in one case, had they considered it and rejected it, then that issue would have been subject to de novo review in the district court, just as we are submitting that it should be in this particular case.
It's de novo review in the district court?
No, it is de novo review. And the authorities...
The district court can't hold a fact... Even on review of the Foreign Service Grievance Board's decision, can the district court take evidence, or does the district court have to consider the administrative record to see whether there's substantial evidence to support the findings?
If it is simply a question of judicial review under the APA, then it's record review.
Right.
If, however, it is a mixed case that includes allegations of discrimination, then the employee is entitled to the same de novo review in district court as he would on any other Title VII claim. And that's the same as the law with respect to other federal employees. It's not unique to Foreign Service employees. It's a separate track. It's a separate statute.
Yeah,
but it's the same.
What I'm trying to figure out is whether you would have been entitled to retry all of the evidentiary findings by the board in a Title VII action when, if you had challenge them in a judicial review action governed by the APA, you would not have been. There can't be pits, the Supreme Court case holds, you can't retry facts that were found before an agency.
Right, and I, Your Honor, I believe that the answer is simply in the tension between record review of ordinary FSGB decisions and de novo review of discrimination claims. And what Congress said is when you have that situation, then you have de novo review of the Title VII claim in district court. And again, I apologize that I can't cite the cases, but this court has held a number of occasions that is, in fact, the analysis.
All right, I'll take a look at that.
And if can I just pursue this a little bit? If I wasn't quite sure I understood your answer to one of Judge Randolph's questions. If it was just a straightforward challenge to the decision of the board, say it had nothing to do with race, would that go to the district court?
It would go to the district court under APA review.
It would go to district court under APA review. Okay. So going back to this case, I want to be sure I understand your theory. Your theory is that although Henwood. Henwood could have reduced the penalty, correct?
Correct.
If Miller had recommended, say, a one-month suspension instead of termination, Henwood could not have recommended removal.
Correct.
Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And under the FAM that we cited in our reply brief, okay, his authority is only he can say, I'm not going to sustain the charges, I'm going to sustain some, or he can change the penalty to what is something less than what has been proposed.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.